we're privileged today to have as our convocation speaker the Reverend Dr. Richard Iyer. He comes to us from Concordia University, Wisconsin, where he serves as Assistant Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Christian Center for Culture, Morality, and Bioethics. Dr. Iyer is a 1965 graduate of this seminary. He received his Doctor of Ministry degree in 1998 from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Deerfield, Illinois. Dr. Iyer has served congregations in Michigan and Wisconsin before serving as Director of Pastoral Care at Grace Hospital in Detroit. From 1976 to 1994, he was the Director of Pastoral Care at Columbia Hospital in Milwaukee and was the Director of Counseling at Concordia University, Wisconsin from 1994 through 1997. Dr. Iyer has a long and distinguished record of serving the larger church and community. In 1984, he served on an ethics panel with Dr. C. Everett Koop, then Surgeon General of the United States. Coping with baby Doe was the focus of that ethics panel. His writing spans several pages. We are going to include for you that bibliography in the library, as well as a printed copy of his words to you this morning. They will be available through the front desk of our library. We're glad that Dr. Iyer came in yesterday, that he took the safer means of travel, namely automobile, his own, because today, at least via the airport, no doubt he would be stranded. We are grateful that the Lord has brought him here safely to us and that we are able to welcome him. We do so.
We left Milwaukee yesterday in 90-degree weather, so it's good to be here in the tropics that you have. I'm going to rush through a presentation that I prepared in order to leave time for discussion, which I hope will then be the better part of this for your questions. In 1994, I left full-time hospital chaplaincy. I left in part because healthcare had changed for the better during the 20 years in which God had called me to serve in this setting. Healthcare had changed for the better for the patient, but it had changed for the worse for me as chaplain. That is, the hospitalized were getting better faster and leaving sooner, and treatments available in doctors' offices often no longer necessitated the patient's hospitalization at all. And as strange as it may sound, I ran out of work to do. Or, more accurately, I lost my access to countless numbers of people in need of pastoral care. There continue, of course, to be hospital patients today, but those who are sick enough to be hospitalized are often also sick enough to be uncommunicative. Others who come and go quickly as patients in a hospital no longer have to endure the long hours of hospitalization and contemplation that serve to quicken the soul and raise those spiritual questions that many keep at arm's length in the course of a normal day of busy lives. The parish pastor's version of the hospital chaplain's bittersweet dilemma is that parishioners now quickly come and go in hospitals and clinics long before the parish pastor even hears that there is a need for pastoral care. But take heart. As parish pastor, you will still have access to those needy parishioners, both in their homes and at worship. One of the contemporary realities and challenges of pastoral care in the parish is that you will have to find ways to provide pastoral care both for those who suffer in a hospital setting, but also those who are at home and in other institutions. The need for pastoral care is great, and the opportunity for the gospel to be spoken is not something you will want to miss. It is a delight to see God at work through your pastoral care of people. In the book, Pastoral Care Under the Cross, I tried to attend to the essence of pastoral care centered on what Luther called the theology of the cross. I took Luther at his word when he wrote, quote, God can be found only in suffering and the cross, unquote. I applied it to the sufferings that we bear today by virtue of living as holy people in an unholy world, even in how we bear sickness differently than those do who do not know Christ. The premise of the book is that, and I'll read here, pastoral care consists not in removing someone's suffering, but in helping the sufferer learn to interpret that suffering in the light of the cross. Whatever contemporary issues or dilemmas in illness you may encounter in the lives of your parishioners, the theology of the cross remains at the heart of pastoral care. That God should work through suffering and the cross to address our need for forgiveness and the healing of lives in this fallen world of sickness and sin. I do not want to merely review what I said for you in my book, but I would like to take a few moments to make some observations on things that I may not have emphasized there. First, it seems to me that parish pastors are often intimidated by the professionalism, technology, and personnel of hospitals and clinics. The well-oiled machinery of surgical procedures and diagnostic labs often stands in stark contrast to the administrative looseness of parish life, and in many cases, the pastor's own lack of discipline. Easily intimidated by the clinical setting, pastors seem to react in one of two ways. Either they withdraw in awe before the medical mystique, on the one hand apologizing for their inadequacy, and on the other mimicking the role of therapist, or they react with disdain and create adversarial relationships with the physicians who represent it. In part, our sense of inadequacy is a reality, since we ourselves confess that, unlike medical technologies, the things of God are not under our control. We are merely messengers and administrators of the mysteries of God. In another sense, our inadequacy is also due to our not having grasped the meaning of pastoral ministry. If our pastoral calling is consumed with making our churches the largest church in town, or with having the most programs and activities for the most people, we will miss the joy of seeing God at work through our pastoral care of individuals. The calling of the pastor as pastor is to address the deepest need of people, whether felt or not, namely their reconciliation with God. Pastoral care is a ministry of confession and absolution, of nourishing lives with the heavenly food of Christ's body and blood, and of investing oneself in the sufferings of those for whom Christ died. Our calling is to help God's holy people live holy lives. The living of holy lives, of lives that reflect the holiness we already possess through the forgiveness of sins, is what we call sanctification. Adolf Kerverly, in The Quest for Holiness, writes, "The desire for sanctification is always first aroused in man when he has become conscious in some painful way of his lack of peace and the erring restlessness of life. So the experiences of age and suffering, of sickness and death that surround us may completely destroy the boundless, worldly, sensuous pleasures that caused us to devote ourselves to the enjoyment of life, and they awaken within us the hunger for a more enduring and deeper meaning to life." In recent years, medical ethics has pandered to the language of quality of life. In the specifics, quality of life defies definition, yet everyone seems to have it nailed down, at least at the level of emotion. People do not fear death, but they fear the loss of quality of life. As pastors, we might well explore with parishioners who suffer greatly the question, what now makes life worth living for you in the midst of your suffering? We may be surprised with a response that affirms no reason for living. But that, too, is grist for the pastor's opportunity for response. The university students I teach are remarkably concerned about meaningful relationships and the recovery of truth. It may not seem that way if we are to judge by the media, but real people do ask real questions, All of this is to say that beneath the superficial level of inane living, there is a hunger for spiritual meaning. Pastoral care connects that hunger with God's food, Christ, the bread of life, and the body and blood of Christ, which feeds the faith. Of all the issues of pastoral care in a hospital setting, none is more challenging than the pastoral care of people in bioethical dilemmas. The legalization of assisted suicide in Oregon last year and the efforts to legalize euthanasia in Michigan recently underscores the temptations soon to be faced by parishioners. In 1975, the case of Karen Ann Quinlan introduced the right to withdraw life support. In 1991, the case of Nancy Cruzan introduced the right to withhold food and water from a comatose patient. In 1998, Oregon has already assisted in the suicide of several people. In all these cases, it was the courts that defined what is ethical and what is not. The church has something better to offer, and it is the parish pastor's obligation not to avoid these bioethical issues that increasingly shape the moral and substantive lives of our parishioners. I was privileged to experience and grow with the rise of medical ethics in a hospital setting from the early 1970s through the late 1990s. I realize how overwhelming it is to parish pastors who have not had that opportunity. But the reluctance of pastors to engage the issues when their parishioners desperately need direction is surely inexcusable. Pastors must become informed about the ethical dilemmas in contemporary healthcare and be able to interpret them to their parishioners. It is imperative to speak truthfully and meaningfully to parishioners in the course of pastoral care and in teaching God's holy people to live holy lives in a fallen world. It is hard work, but it is not impossible work. There's a great deal of reluctance on the part of Lutheran pastors to be any more involved in bioethics than is absolutely necessary. This is due in part to the overwhelming nature of bioethics, the unpreparedness of Lutheran pastors to deal with ethics in a Lutheran way, and the aversion to becoming involved in the politicized struggle between pro-life and pro-choice peoples, especially in their parishes. At another level, Lutherans have also been reluctant to trade theology for the moralism in ethics, and rightly so. Luther himself said, "Be sure that you do not make Christ into Moses," as if the gospel were simply a textbook of teachings or laws. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a Lutheran who laid his life on the line for what he believed to be ethically right, said, "Christianity and ethics do indeed have nothing to do with one another. There is no Christian ethic, and there can be no transition from the idea of Christianity to that of ethics." Strange thing for him to say. But what he is saying here is that ethical principles cannot be torn from the fabric of the Christian faith as if they could exist without it. There is no Christian ethics as principles to live by, applicable to believer and non-believer alike. To offer the means of sanctification before the need for justification is satisfied would be to cast pearls before swine. In spite of an American evangelical interpretation to this effect, the Christian faith is not about principles to live by. It is about what God has done in Christ to make us holy people who live holy lives as the fruit of the Spirit. As Lutherans, we do not preach or teach a moralism of do's and don'ts. We preach the gospel, and we teach its application, the pulpit for proclamation and the Bible class for teaching. Having said this, Lutheran pastors must learn to provide pastoral care to those parishioners faced with bioethical dilemmas. In a manuscript I've entitled Holy People, Holy Lives, Law and Gospel and Bioethics, which is currently at CPH being considered for publication, I propose that such pastoral care be centered on the proper distinction between law and gospel. The pastoral care of parishioners faced with a bioethical dilemma requires that we speak both law and gospel. Because we are simul justus et peccator, we speak law to the old Adam in us who needs to know the limits beyond which we ought not go, and the gospel to the new creation that we are in Christ that bears the fruit of the Spirit at work in us. It is the proper distinction between law and gospel that is crucial to pastoral care in issues of bioethics. The temptation is always to address bioethics only with law. But it is the gospel that changes hearts and makes us holy people. Holiness describes our relationship with God, secured through the forgiveness of sins, the work of the gospel. Holiness is not a moral quality attained by right living under the law. As Lutheran pastors, we are not Pharisees who police ethics, determining what does and doesn't violate the law. Even if we wish to do so, it would be an impossible task to speak an unerring word that distinguishes good from evil in the biomedical ethical choices parishioners must make. As important as the distinction is between good and evil, the Lutheran approach is not one that focuses on these distinctions as the solution to the problem. To bear good fruit, the tree must be healthy. Ethics for Lutherans is first of all about who and whose we are, and only then about the actions that we perform. Again, Bonhoeffer writes, man at his origin knows only one thing, God. But the knowledge of good and evil shows that he is no longer at one with his origin. The Lutheran approach to bioethics does not rest on our knowledge of good and evil, but on the one thing needful, God. Our path in life is not to follow the fine distinctions between law, but to walk the way of the cross where we are crucified with Christ. So it is ultimately gospel and not law that transforms us to see rightly in ethical dilemmas. Let me now give you some example of how this works, some contemporary issues in bioethics. There are three areas of bioethics that will call upon parish pastors most commonly to provide pastoral care in the future. Certainly end-of-life decision-making with us now, reproductive technologies, increasingly, and ultimately genetic engineering. Let me address each in terms of the need for pastoral care. End-of-life decision-making. End-of-life decision-making involves choices that could, in the thinking of ethicist Gil Mylander, either aim at death or merely result in death. Mylander makes the distinction between aiming at death, which he concludes is euthanasia, and decisions that merely result in death, calling this unintentional and not euthanasia. The significance of Mylander's distinction, which I think is invaluable, is that he defines euthanasia comprehensively as that at which we aim rather than that which we merely do. It is clear, for example, that a lethal injection given a patient is euthanasia. It is not clear, however, to observers that turning off a respirator, that is, denying life support, for a comatose patient who is 100% dependent on that respirator, it is not clear that that also is euthanasia, since the only reason that we would turn off the respirator is to aim at the death of the patient. And so we could go on to develop many scenarios to illustrate what is and is not euthanasia. While we are concerned here not with euthanasia, rather with the pastoral care of those faced with end-of-life decision-making. What are the issues of pastoral care where decision-making leaves open the option to aim at death? Why would someone choose death? There are some superficial reasons, such as cost-effectiveness, not wanting to burden a family, the civil right to do so, and so on. And there are even some weightier reasons, such as the desire we all have to depart and be with Christ. To want this is not to sin, but to choose to die by our own hand or by the hand of a surrogate is. The discerning pastor will always ask a patient or a sympathetic family member choosing to aim at death, why? Some answers come to mind. Perhaps it is due to the unwillingness to live with less than life has been up until now. Perhaps the fear of anticipated suffering tempts us to take matters into our own hands. Perhaps frustration and a sense of helplessness drive some to grasp for control, at least over the manner, time, and place of death. And this does not exhaust the list of reasons. Others may be known only by listening carefully and skillfully to the parishioners who speak them, never assuming that what you have heard from one parishioner is exactly the same as what another one is telling you. Here is the skill of pastoral care as I perceive it: to listen attentively, to keep silence for a time, to let the sufferer tell you the interpretation of his or her suffering, to help him or her uncover the sin in that interpretation, to gently turn him in the direction of confessing sin so that you may give absolution, to bring the word of God that gives life in the midst of death, to pray and commune with the bread of life. This is what you have to offer the suffering. No other profession can do this. Addressing the issues of helplessness and control, for example, can only be addressed rightly through pastoral care. The pastor must help the sufferer learn that helplessness is something Christians may thrive on, for it puts us in touch with the one who is our help. Not having control over our lives is the opportunity to learn to love and trust in God. The sum of my ministry and pastoral care in a hospital setting can be said to be helping people make the connection between God in their sufferings and learning to love and trust in God. Reproductive technologies. Recently, a newborn child was claimed by 8 people to be its parents. There was the originating couple who contracted with a married woman for her egg to be donated, implicating the approval of her husband in her decision. The contracting of a married man for his sperm, implicating the approval of his wife in his decision. The employment of a married surrogate, implicating the approval of her husband in the decision to carry the embryo created by in vitro fertilization for the initiating couple. At the child's birth, all had a change of heart and decided to claim the child as their own. In a court of law, it was observed by the judge that there were no existing laws to address this unusual dilemma, and so the judge declared that the child had no legal parents at all. You may or may not be spared the pastoral task of ministering to people such as these, but you will surely have some parishioners who make use of some reproductive technologies along the way. Indeed, there may be some of you here today who are parents because you have made use of such technologies. But there are technologies and there are technologies. The Vatican, attempting to address this complicated issue, it determined that technologies which assist rather than replace natural procreation are acceptable. But the Vatican statement is a theological one and is not intended to address the pastoral aspect of ministering to those who make use of acceptable or even unacceptable technologies. Without being able to address the plethora of issues in this brief presentation, there are nevertheless some basic things that pastors must provide in the pastoral care of people with such aims. Pastoral care must be preceded by preparation in the parish. In preaching, proclamation of the gospel as the forgiveness of sins and the good news of God's care of his holy people is always assumed. In teaching, the biblical meanings of marriage and conception need to be taught to parishioners before they are faced with the choices posed by reproductive technologies. The themes of our teaching ought to include an understanding of marriage as the one-flesh union of husband and wife, usually resulting in procreation. Children are a gift from God, a gift that may not be received in a marriage. It seems to me that the use of technologies to identify causes of infertility and to assist in their correction are acceptable. But there are other technologies available that we should decline because they violate the biblical meaning of marriage and conception. For example, going outside the marriage, beyond the one-flesh union, to conceive through the use of donors or surrogates surely violates the intention of God for procreation. In ministering to those who consider or who practice such things, the following skills of pastoral care may be necessary. To listen sympathetically to the sorrow of childless couples. To help couples articulate what it means for them to have or to not have a child of their own. To help couples understand the biblical meanings of marriage and conception in the case of their particulars. To gently assist couples in confessing sins such as the desperation that makes childbearing all so consuming in their marriage. Perhaps even the anger toward God for God's having withheld that gift, and to pronounce absolution on their confession of sins. To help couples turn from fulfillment found in childbearing or in having a child to fulfillment found ultimately always for all of us in God. To visit and pray with couples until they have finished with their grief over not having a child. It goes without saying that adoption is an alternative to childlessness, even as adoption is an alternative to abortion in the one unmarried with a child. As infertility continues to rise in this country, the pastor will be faced with more and more options confronting parishioners. Issues of covetousness toward donor sperm and egg, adulterous desire for union with someone other than spouse in the conception of a child, the breaking of the bond between mother and child when a surrogate becomes pregnant for the purpose of giving the child away, making the child a commodity, all these and other issues will challenge the pastor's need to provide pastoral care. Rather than view these issues with dread in your pastoral care of people, see them as opportunities to shepherd God's flock to the shepherd among them in the midst of their childlessness. Genetic engineering. The Human Genome Project, I'm going to assume you know what that is, but you can ask later if you don't. The Human Genome Project, sponsored by the federal government, will soon have mapped every gene in the body. We will soon know what genes or combination of genes cause what diseases, and we will also know what genes contribute to what traits make us who we are. In short, the knowledge we gain by this project will offer us the opportunity to heal disease and or to enhance human traits, such as eye color, height, and a host of other things. Some genetic manipulation is already in progress, but few of our parishioners are directly involved in this activity. It would be novel for us as the church to speak proactively rather than reactively about what we see as the spiritual issues already at stake in the writings of ethicists and others who view all scientific capabilities as progress rather than as matters for discrete evaluation. Why, for example, would we wish to enhance human traits? We might speculate that a low self-image could be enhanced by being taller or faster or more acutely aware of sight or sound, or we could imagine that power and control over others would be a tempting option through greater alertness and quickness of mind, all through genetic alteration. It is immaterial that these alterations may never be possible, but the attitude that desires them is one that deserves the attention of pastors in their pastoral care of people. The theology that might well address this is the biblical meaning of our being created in the image of God. It is not that such an image is physical and that we might be offending God to try to improve our physical being, nor is it that the image of God consists merely in attributes we share with God, such as self-awareness, rationality, the deliberate exercise of the will, etc. If this were so, what if in a coma we no longer possessed one of these attributes? Could it be said that we no longer are made in the image of God? I think not. Rather, the image of God has to do with the nature of our relationship with God that is unique to our species. Differentiated from plants, animals, and the environment, we humans bear the likeness of God. That is, we are one with Him in holiness. That holiness, that image of God lost in the fall and restored to us in Christ, is only a dim reflection of the intent of God in those who are lost and condemned sinners without God's forgiveness. Genetic engineering that moves beyond the aim of healing to enhancement may convey the message that value and worth is found in our attributes and not in our relationship with God. It feeds the notion that physical, emotional, and intellectual is all there are to a human being. Pastors interpreting genetic engineering for enhancement of traits will want to help parishioners move beyond the tempting novelty of it all to the deeper spiritual implications. The healthcare of the future will center on genetic engineering and will involve parents making decisions about their offspring, choosing to have their own gametes altered to produce the kind of children they desire, perhaps determining the sex of a child. As knowledge of genetic possibilities becomes available, pastors will have to teach their parishioners about the issues and the biblical themes that address them. It is barely possible at this stage to say what the pastoral response ought to be to possibilities yet unknown, but pastors need to know and believe that the gospel which pronounces forgiveness also changes hearts, tempted to take charge of life at the very core of what it means to be a child of God. And so in conclusion, I began with the distinction between law and gospel as the tools of pastoral care in bioethics. Indeed, it will be necessary to speak law and set limits beyond which Christians will not want to go in their end-of-life decision-making, in reproductive technologies, and in genetic engineering. But it is the gospel that will address those underlying maladies and transform lives when we are tempted to violate the limits God has set for us as his holy people. In euthanasia, the temptation is to resolve our helplessness and loss of control and suffering by taking our lives into our own hands and out of the hands of God. In reproductive technologies, the temptation will be to make children of our own in the absence of not having begotten them as a gift of God. In genetic engineering, the temptation will be to remake ourselves in the image of man in the absence of the image of God that is restored only in Christ. The gospel addresses these temptations as the proclamation that God is our help in helplessness, our fulfillment in marriage, and our gracious reconciler to himself and those who hunger to be remade in his image. In him we find what we are looking for in much of what some of bioethics offers as a substitute for God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Thank you. Well, I rushed, as you may have sensed. And the usual reaction, frankly, to speaking on this topic is absolute silence, since people have no idea where to begin or what questions to raise, but such an astute body as this, I'm sure, can challenge some of this. I guess there are microphones here that we wish you to use if you have a question. Yes?
Good morning. I've had the difficult experience of having to admit two parents to nursing homes, and the nursing homes today insist on an answer of do or do not resuscitate. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you've had any experience in that area and could address those issues.
Sure. I think it was in 1991 that federal law required all hospitals, nursing homes, and other healthcare institutions to at least ask every person admitted to them, do you have a medical directive, either a living will or a durable power of attorney for healthcare? If the answer is no, they were instructed to ask the people, would you like to have one? We will provide it for you. But by law, no coercion is allowed. You can say, no, I don't have one, and no, I don't want one, if that's your choice. Which then makes it impossible for the nursing home or the hospital to take any action that would be life-threatening or life-ending. If you decide that you do want to have one of those, you can usually write in there the things that you do not want done, the qualifications, and so on. But the point of your question is about the pressure put on by nursing homes, perhaps, and others. That really is not legal. The federal mandate made it very strong that coercion is not permitted. So declining life-saving procedures, you know, is something that's in your hands, not their hands. If you say, I want everything done, by law, they should have to do that. I'm not sure do everything you can is a good answer.
there are a lot of intricacies in terms of what perhaps we should and shouldn't do, particularly to people in a nursing home who are traditionally elderly as well as ill. For example, I'm not sure that calling a code that is trying to practice CPR on a 85 or 90 year old is a good idea. Generally, such people don't survive very long after the code because of the code. Because in the process of a code, what you're doing is impounding the chest, which probably cracks ribs, which probably makes it hard for the patient to breathe deeply, which then leads to pneumonia, and they usually die of pneumonia. So there are some medical contraindications for things that you might just not want to do. But you should be able to talk to your doctor. You should be able to talk together as a family, make your decision, and then make it very clearly known to the nursing home or the hospital. Patient, if he or she's conscious, has to do that legally. Or you may be designated as an agent, as a durable power of attorney for healthcare, for example, where you have the legal word as to what can and can't be done. Other questions?
Good morning, thank you. I noticed in the end there, when you were talking about the limits as set by God, I sort of got a comfortable feeling in the way that you described them, and I found myself agreeing with you, but isn't sort of the pat answer that comes back from that, well, then where are these limits? You could argue that the airplane surpasses the limits that God set for men, or for that matter, penicillin. So you could give us some guidelines as into discovering where these limits that are set by God are, and do they lie necessarily in the technology itself?
That's a good question. The simplistic answer would be God did not say thou shalt not fly, but he did say thou shalt not kill. That's probably the clearest and simplest form. And killing, in the texts that we refer to that, refer to killing the innocent. It's not necessarily in war. In fact, God gives command of war in the Old Testament in those circumstances, etc. But the limit thou shalt not kill, I guess, is an assumption I make that we agree on. The question is, when are we killing and when are we not? And that's what makes technology makes it difficult to know at times when we are killing and when we're not. This is why I like Mylander's definition of killing or euthanasia as being when we aim at death. If that is our aim and our intent, no matter how we do it, whether it's by omission or commission, it is killing, and therefore it violates the limits God has given us. And reproductive technologies, for me, one of the fairly clear limits is found in the definition of what marriage is. Some of you may have a disagreement with it. I don't know what it would be because I've been trying to think of it myself. But if marriage is understood as the one flesh union of two people, then it seems to me a third person entering for the purpose of conception violates that oneness. And so as a principle or a limiting factor, I would suggest that those things which actually involve gametes, for example, in the conception of a child would be outside the realm of what God intends for us. In genetic engineering, since not everything is well developed in terms of possibilities, it's hard to be specific there. But it seems to me that it is within the realm of biblical practice on the part of our Lord and the disciples to heal, and so genetic engineering, which aims at healing diseases, certainly seems to be compatible with the Christian faith. But the enhancement of traits, depending on what they are, I suppose, I don't want to be absolute on this, but I guess I'm speaking as a counselor for the last 30 years and as a pastoral caregiver, that I always want to know why people want what they want, and why would we want to enhance our future generations? And there are probably far more subtle answers than I have given. I've tried to give them some dramatic ones to at least give some thought to it. But I suppose just the idea that somehow we want to be in control of future generations, that we want to set the pace of life for them ahead of time in a way beyond teaching and so on, where they have some choice. To genetically alter gametes to produce a child, for example, the way we want that child to turn out, certainly doesn't give the child any choice to say no about it, which would be a little different than, say, teaching where the child could reject that and so on. One of the reasons I don't like, and I haven't here presented specific cases, is that generic cases don't have any specifics. And in pastoral care, it's the specifics that give direction to us. And so I would deal with people's aims, motivations, and so on, the somewhat subjective things, not as the final word, but ultimately as the way of reaching people to give pastoral care to them. And, you know, I have not said it because, again, for lack of time, and because in a relativistic age we already believe this, that there are a lot of gray areas. I'm not so sure that there are as many gray areas as we think there are. I think we try to accommodate to the culture. I don't think we take a step back and ask, what is law and gospel in terms of what we're addressing here. And I think the closer we get theologically to ethical issues, the clearer it becomes what the limits are, but also what God has done for us that takes away some of the choices that we don't have to deal with. I don't want to take too much time because I want to give you questions, but let me just say that in the book that I hope will be published by CPH, and you can all call down there and tell me you want this to happen, the point of the book is that I want to show how if we look at the issues themselves, we will see certainly some limits God places upon us. But as we look at the malady, the problem in the dilemma, I really believe somehow the gospel addresses that, not just in the forgiveness of sins, which of course it does, but it seems to me that what God has done in creating us the way we are, God's action, the good news of marriage, for example, says a lot to us about what we have to offer the world so that some of the options that are out there are really foolish. Ephesians 5 text that speaks about marriage and compares it to our relationship between a husband and wife, compares it to our relationship with God, surely shows us a lot of what God has done in bringing about the relationship and how God is at work in it and what his intention is and so on that needs to be God's action and not ours to take into hand. Other questions? Why not?
Well, since Paul Robbie isn't here. Augie, I'm reminded of that old Sunday school story that does speak to the future of aviation about the flight into Egypt with Pontius, the pilot. That's an old joke. But I was intrigued by your comments early on of your in your own ministry, how you found a chaplaincy role in a hospital changing. Could you speak to the future of that niche within the Holy Ministry as a specialized focus? Is that changing to the point that that no longer really is a specialized ministry? Does it change into something else? I'm thinking of the tremendous amount of energy in our society devoted to nursing care and the aging of America. And with that, perhaps also the relationship from your perspective of how a parish pastor complements and interacts with the role of a specialized chaplaincy.
Okay. What I said, of course, stemmed from my being deeply involved as a hospital chaplain in 1974 to being, I would say, peripherally involved by 1994. Only in the sense that patients came and went so fast that sometimes by the time I got a referral, they had already been discharged. The parish pastors who came and went through my office to visit parishioners found that to some degree as well. Often by the time they got there, the patient had left and they were back home again. However, those who are admitted are usually critically ill or certainly more seriously ill and therefore need pastoral care all the more. But the pastoral care there may be to the family sitting in the intensive care lounge, for example. You may not have a lot of access to the patient. But you should understand human dynamics and psychology enough to realize, as well theologically, that patients somehow are accessible even when they're not conscious. I remember a lady that I had learned about, did not get to know her personally, but through her family learned that she was a Christian and got a background and so from her. When I went into the intensive care lounge to see her, she was in a light coma, which still meant that she was not responsive rationally or consciously to anything. But I sang to her, an old hymn that they said she knew. I sang it very quietly in her ear, and a tear trickled down. That's the only response that I got. But I guess it communicated something back, that this was deeply meaningful to her. I think parish pastors ought not give up on pastoral care in a hospital setting, but I think you have to gear up toward a more emergency type of situation, critical care, and not be intimidated by all the technology when you go into the intensive care lounge, for example, or into the unit, rather. You ought to ask a nurse to instruct you, what is all this equipment? You know, you could say sometime, could you just give me a little tour of the place? Help me understand what's going on. Don't be afraid to act like you don't know what it all is, because maybe you don't. There's nothing wrong with that. And usually the staff is more than eager to help educate you in what it is, because they do see you as supportive of the patient and the family. I think the staff, if they come to respect you as not antagonistic and threatening or challenging them, which some pastors do. Some pastors come in with preconceived ideas that all this stuff is offensive and so on. If you understand what's going on there, it all makes sense. And if you come in with that attitude and want to learn and want to be a part and support of it all, generally the nursing staff as well as the doctors will be more than happy to let you deal with things that they're not qualified to deal with and don't want to deal with, namely the pastoral care of people. In a nursing home setting, it's a little bit different. I think there you will be dealing with people, certainly who are there long enough to minister to, but maybe not there mentally enough that you can do a whole lot with them. But I recall even in parish ministry many years ago that there were patients who it made their day for me to come as a pastor. It meant a lot to them. It means a lot to families to know that the pastor is ministering to people who never get to church, whom no one ever prays with or communes. I certainly don't want to discourage visitation in healthcare institutions. It's absolutely necessary. But you have to understand the setting. Maybe as young men going into the ministry who don't know any different, this is not going to be a problem, and you'll take things at a level where they are. What I have described is somewhat the frustration historically of having less and less and less and less opportunity to reach people. But I think visiting in homes is important, the sick and elderly. You'll have people in your parishes who will do this for you if you want them to, the elders and women groups and individuals and so on, and that's all fine, but that doesn't take the place of pastoral care, particularly if patients, parishioners, are conscious and they want to talk to you about the things that really matter. They will talk to you. They won't talk to parishioners that they're going to see later on. And don't forget the whole issue of individual confession and absolution, a fantastically necessary ministry. Conclusion, let me just tell you about an 80-some-year-old lady in the geropsychiatry unit in there for depression because, among other things, she had had an abortion when she was in her 20s. And in her 80s, it still bothered her. And she needed pastoral care. She needed absolution. So don't underestimate the need at all. Is that my cue? Okay. Other questions?
Yes, in our discussion this morning, we've been basically dealing with more or less the patient's perspective mm-hmm. of these various bioethical issues. Can you give us some guidelines as to how to address the medical professionals themselves
oh, okay.
as
good.
They are living in an industry that's getting increasingly relativistic?
Yes.
Thank you.
In the period of time in which I served in healthcare, it was interesting that the doctors initially were of the traditional patriarchal breed who were authoritarian in many ways and so on, to the point where if I would walk in a room and a doctor was with the patient, the doctor wouldn't even allow me in the room. But by the end of my 20-year stay, if the doctor saw me in the door, he would beg me to come in and stay at the bedside and take all the time that I needed. Medical students have changed this regard too. I always found ministry to the doctor to be not only important, but also tremendously satisfying.
Many clergy, and I'm not sure why this is, maybe it's the intimidation that I talked about, our own feelings of inadequacy or whatever, but many clergy seem to develop an adversarial relationship with doctors in a hospital. The assumption that the doctor is imposing treatment or whatever, or is insensitive, or you listen to the patient and the patient complains about the doctor and the nurses and everything, take all of that with a grain of salt. Because if you ask, there are two things you can do to be helpful to the staff. You can ask at the nursing station, I'd like to speak to the nurse caring for Mrs. So-and-so. Ask specifically. Don't just ask, can someone tell me about Mrs. So-and-so. Ask for the nurse caring for her. And then the nurse will usually sit down and say, you know, what can I do for you? What do you need to know? And you can simply say, can you fill me in on what's happening so that I can be supportive of both the patient and the family? That's not threatening. That's helpful to the nurse. You can also ask, is the doctor who is caring for Mr. So-and-so available? I'd like to speak with him for a moment. If he or she is there, which is kind of a matter of hit and miss, if you can talk with the doctor face-to-face and say the same thing, they will be very receptive, I think. You can also call a doctor on the phone, but nowadays they will probably say, well, I can't give you information legally, you know, about this patient, etc. But it depends. I'm finding that some of the younger doctors are a little bit more fluid in that, and they treat you as a professional in their mind who is not going to violate confidences, and don't, if they tell you things about the patient, don't go back and tell the family, guess what I found out. That would do you in, both with the doctor as well as with the patient and the family, probably. You need to build a rapport with the staff, and you need to minister to them. You might want to say to the nurse or the doctor who has described a difficult situation with a patient to say, this has got to be a difficult patient to care for. That's an invitation to say, oh, you better believe it. You don't know what we've been through, et cetera, and then to unload. Or you might simply say, you know, I really respect what you're doing for this patient or appreciate it. I don't know if you feel comfortable doing this, but because I was on site for so long and got to know people, in my early years before I learned more, I remember sitting with a patient who was in tears, and we started to pray, and a neurosurgeon burst into the room with about five or six other medical students and began talking to the patient immediately in the midst of all of this. And for the patient's sake, I just kind of drew back and let him finish. And then I said to the patient, I'll be right back. And I left the room and followed him down the hall, and I called him, and I said, Dr. So-and-so, can I speak to you for a moment in the this empty room here? And he came in, and I said to him, you know, I'm going to assume that you really do care for the patient you just saw, but you really didn't show it very well. Well, his face flushed in anger at me, and he said, well, that's your job to care for that patient. That's not my job. And I said, well, I know it is, but I know you care about this patient. Her life is in your hands, and I think she needs to know that, and you need to communicate that to her. And he huffed and puffed and stormed out of the room. That was it. I didn't want to call him to account in front of the other medical students or nurses or anybody. A day or two later, I was walking down the hall, and I heard this timid voice down the hall calling my name, and I turned around, and it was this neurosurgeon. And he came up to me, and he said, I've got another patient I wonder if you could see and give me some help with, which was the beginning of breaking down the distance between us, that he respected me, that I was objective in my criticism of him, and he was able to be mature enough to receive it, so that we began eventually to work very closely with patients. Now, I don't advise trying that, you know, unless you have a lot of experience in the hospital setting. And I had also built the trust of the medical staff so that when he went to complain about me, they all backed me up. But I was called on the carpet by the ethics committee one time where I disagreed with a doctor. We had an argument in the hall for a while, and it was a very friendly argument. We actually ended up hugging each other at the end. But another doctor observed this and went to the ethics committee. I heard he was going to censure me or whatever they do, even though I founded the ethics committee and served on for 8 years. But I decided to test the waters and not go back to the committee and let them handle it without me and see what happened. And I heard from those who were there that he came, he made his complaint about me, and another doctor got up and said, Pastor Iyer's not here. We trust what he's doing. Next item of business. That was the end of it. So you have to build trust and rapport. That's the key in a clinical setting.